And you are all PSI students, I gather. And one of the first things I want to ask is which of the courses have you taken? Because I know that you take a lot of things. And I'm particularly interested in the cosmology course, the follow-on cosmology course, the standard model course, the follow-on beyond the standard model course. So who here has taken the cosmology course? So most, but not everybody, all right. And then how about the follow-on cosmology course, which I think that's happening now. So who's taking that in parallel? So some of you are, okay. And the standard model course, who took that? So you, pretty much everybody took that. And the beyond the standard model course. So about half and half. Okay. And actually, since I'm asking you things, I don't know if you guys are far enough along to know where your heart lies. Are you, you know, who amongst you sees yourself heading into cosmology as opposed to particle physics, as opposed to gravity, as opposed to condensed matter physics or other things? So I guess, so of those topics, who amongst you are thinking of particle physics and cosmology as your main interests as opposed to a side interest? So some aren't, all right. So those who are not interested, whose main interest is not particle physics and cosmology, what are the interests? So those of you who didn't have your hand up, well, do you know, or is it gravity, or is it?
Does string theory count as particle physics?
you know, it's funny. That's a good question, because in the old days I would have said yes, but it's true that it's evolved since then, and it's So I would say that counts as particle physics. of those of you who had not had your hands up, are you mostly string interested, or?
Yeah, string, condensed matter.
Condensed matter, oh, yeah, okay. All right, so there's a variety of things. So the way I want to approach this course is, traditionally this course has been taught as a dark matter course, and I don't want to do that, unless you all complain. So I'm not completely, it's not cast in stone yet what we're going to do, but my vision was that this course should be cool topics in particle astrophysics, because if you think of the five things that we know about nature that are not described by the standard model, four of them come from particle astrophysics. So there's many of the big unsolved problems are in this area. So I thought it was better to talk about several of them rather than dark matter specifically. And the goal is not really to bring you so that sell you a particular model of any one of these, the solutions to any one of these problems. But the goal is really, I think every course should tell a story at some level. And the story that I'd like this course to tell is, actually several stories, but probably the transferable tool that I'd like you to get from this course, which you're probably also getting in some of the other courses that you took, was the utility of phrasing things in terms of effective field theories. And there's several levels, so I'll say what those are, and there's several levels at which it's useful, one of which is controlling your approximations. But another one is, you'll see that when we look at some proposals for dark matter, for example, some of them are difficult to pin down. And the reason they're difficult to pin down is the rules are always, if you're trying to solve something new, you have to not screw up everything you didn't that was already working. And so you have to say, what's most useful is if you say, the degrees of freedom and the interactions that are going on in the relevant energies are these ones, and then anybody can take those things and not only see if you're solving the problem you wanted to solve, but also see if you're not screwing up the things that you're not supposed to screw up. And that's a much more useful way to cast any proposal than it is to say, I'm going to go in and cherry pick this one piece of physics and change it, and not really give you a framework for describing everything else, because then you don't really know what you've changed and what you haven't changed. So part of the underlying subliminal message will be the utility of effective field theories, but I'll use these three of the five outstanding problems in particle astrophysics to kind of as examples. So the overview of where I wanted to go. Can you read that in the back? Yeah. All right, so if you kind of said what's wrong with the standard model, standard model has been around longer than I have been around in particle physics, and carries with it the standard model of cosmology. And you might say after you're beyond the standard model course that what's wrong with the standard model is something like the hierarchy problem or things like that, and that's not wrong. But what I want to focus on is what's, you know, observationally wrong. So there's kind of two classes of things that could be wrong with our picture of nature. Some of them are kind of aesthetic or issues that we think theoretically are could be a problem or might not be a problem. And I'm going to get to things like the hierarchy problem as part of this too. But the more important ones are the ones where you just have an observational fact that's just in your way. And I would say that there are basically five of these that are problematic for the standard model. So five observations that suck. Do not work with the standard model. So the one that's not cosmology, I would say, is neutrino masses. So there's neutrino oscillations have been seen. Very little doubt that they're happening. You know, they were historically first observed with astrophysical things like solar neutrinos and atmospheric neutrinos. But you can now see them by producing neutrinos on Earth. And the neutrinos are not doing what the standard model says they should do. What the standard model says they should do is they should be massless and they should conserve lepton number for each species of each generation. And these experiments in short form just say that's not true, that there's those lepton numbers are not conserved. I'm kind of going to skim over that because that's not really the focus of this course, but it's probably the most concrete because you can actually touch it in the lab here. And then all the rest of them come from cosmology. So there's the issue of what's the dark matter. There's the issue of what's the dark energy. So both those are in the same spirit, and they're based on the fact that the standard cosmology has a tale to tell as to what the total energy density in the universe is, regardless of whether you can see it. And so it's the first time in the history of man we know kind of what the energy distribution in the universe is. And something like 95% of it is nothing that's in the standard model. So this is something like 25% of what's out there. And this is something like 70% of what's out there. And whatever it is, it's not in the standard model. As we'll talk about, and as you've no doubt talked about already, is this stuff is being inferred. Its existence is being inferred through how it gravitates. So part of what you could mean by explaining these things is you could be modifying gravity in such a way as to remove the need for new kinds of matter. And I'm going to call that what's wrong with the standard model because I remember having a discussion with a student a couple years ago, and the discussion was, what if there's a non-particle physics solution to the dark matter problem? And I remember thinking, that sentence doesn't actually parse as a sentence to me because as a particle physicist, if you modify, what the person meant was, you know, maybe it's a modification of gravity that's happening and not some new particle. But to me, particle physics is physics. And so if you modify gravity, that's modifying particle physics because gravitons are one of the particles. And so in this story I'm talking about, when I'm asking about changing the standard model, what I really mean by the standard model is the basic standard model plus GR, general relativity. And modifications to either of those things I'm counting as modifications of the standard model. And so the issue there is, so what is this stuff? It's not in the standard model when I say the standard model includes general relativity. Point four would be what you could call primordial fluctuations. So that's the, and I guess then the point five will be baryogenesis. And these kind of are in a same, and very similar, these are about initial conditions, whereas those are about what's in the universe now. And more or less what these things both say is that the picture of cosmology we have works great as long as you start it off in just the right spot. And if you let it start off at the right spot and let it go, then it does what we see. But that spot that you started off at is kind of very bizarre at two levels. The primordial fluctuation story is the one that says that if you look at the temperature of the microwave background across the sky, it's very highly correlated at different directions. In particular, the temperature is very close to the same in all directions. And if you take the standard model and you say, I run it back in time, what did the universe look like? It kind of starts at a time so recent that there hasn't been enough time for light to cross the sky to tell the sky it's all supposed to be at 3 degrees. And so it's a very, very funny initial set of correlations that are being set up in the sky if you think that all that's in the universe is a standard model. So this is the line of inquiry that says, could I have changed the extrapolation into the past in such a way as to change how long there was available to set up the properties that we see in the sky? And that extrapolation is the one that leads you, depending on who you are, to inflation or to bouncing cosmologies or other things. But it's all about how do you explain these correlations that are in the sky. And baryogenesis is a similar one. You know, we see the universe is full of baryons, baryons being protons, neutrons, as opposed to electrons and photons, say, and neutrinos. And so we don't see any anti-baryons, and the universe is consistent with just being baryons. And nothing wrong with that at face value, but if you run things back in time to the earlier times when the universe is very hot, once the temperature is much bigger than the mass of the proton or the mass of the neutron, so that's about 100, you know, what about a GeV, if there's an excess of protons and neutrons now, in that everything's protons and neutrons as opposed to antiprotons and antineutrons, at very high temperatures, that what that meant was there were roughly equal numbers of particles and antiparticles, but there was just a little bit more of particles compared to antiparticles, and a little bit more means like 1 part in 10 to the 10 more. And so when the temperature fell through the temperatures where the protons and neutrons started to annihilate with the antiprotons and antineutrons, they all found a partner except for, you know, the one, it's like musical chairs. There's the one person who was kind of walking around the room when the music stopped and had no partner, and that's what we see is around us now. And that, these two things needn't require changes to the laws of nature. It could just be that that's the way nature starts, and maybe baryon number is conserved, and maybe the universe started off with just a little excess of protons and neutrons, and that might be all that we get to know about it. But it kind of seems very weird, and so if you had to hierarchically rank how you feel about these things, these ones, I think these are all the most solid observational problems with the standard model, and these ones, the initial conditions, you may or may not be bothered by choosing special initial conditions. But part of the argument here will be that they are very unstable conditions to have chosen. So the goal is to talk about, I'm going to focus on these three. So these two and this one. But I can throw in other things if you're interested. And there's roughly 3 weeks, so roughly kind of a week each, although there's a little bit more to say, but you'll see that the dark matter, dark matter is kind of the poster child of how you think about these things, because there's a variety of approaches to it, which you can. We're not going to go through them all. It's not going to be a laundry list. But you can kind of assess the relative, how people are doing, how well the different explanations are doing. So for instance, you can compare modified gravity to weak interacting massive particles to other things. And the important part of the story here, I would say, is that the story about dark matter and dark energy is very much like the story of atoms 100 years ago, that somebody is trying to convince you that there's stuff out there that you haven't seen and you're not likely to see in the future for a while, or you know, hopefully soon, but could be a while. And that's very much like the case that was being made for atoms at the turn of the 20th century, where there was no hope really to see atoms in those days. But they really became convinced at some point that atoms exist, and they weren't just kind of some mathematical thing, they really existed. And what convinced them at the time kind of defines what a good argument is for saying that these kind of things exist. And so what convinced them at the time wasn't any one line of argument. It was that there was 50 lines of argument, that you could infer the properties of atoms many different ways, thinking about thermodynamics or thinking about looking at Brownian motion or a whole bunch of what could have been independent ways of thinking about what was going on, but they all gave you the same thing when you asked what the properties would have to have been for the atoms. And that's what made the argument convincing, way before you could see atoms. So for anyone to convince you that there is a dark matter, or they've explained dark matter, or there's a problem to be solved here, the whole story has to be more than one line of argument. So when we go through these, I want to kind of start off with what's the evidence for these things. And it has to be not one piece of evidence. It has to be many lines of evidence that all point to the same kind of a story. And when we're assessing how well different proposals are doing, the virtue of having many lines of evidence is exactly that. If you have a convincing description, it'll get all the lines of evidence right at once, and it'll always tell you the same story about what is at root. And something that's not convincing won't do that. And so where I'm going to go with this is I'm going to focus probably on the two simplest proposals, one of which is the modified gravity proposal, and one of which is a kind of a particle physics proposal. And I want to argue for you that either of them could be right in the long term, but right now, the preponderance of evidence is that the particle approach is a better one because it captures all of these lines of evidence that are, and there's 7 or 8 lines of evidence for dark matter. Whereas the gravity ones, there's no proposal which does better than getting one of them right or two of them right. And so the message there will be assessing the evidence and effective theories are a good way to do that in the sense that they allow you to really look at the implications of a proposal for the things that you're trying to explain, but also the things that you're hoping not to ruin. Dark energy, you'll see, is a much shadier game in the sense that there's only 2 or 3 lines of evidence for it. Pretty good evidence, but it's there, but it's not as much as for dark matter. But what's interesting from the point of view of theorists, and probably you're all theorists, is that unlike dark matter, there's no proposal here which everybody agrees is even a candidate to work. So the usual picture would have been you have 3 or 4 proposals that all could have been all theoretically could have been working, and you ask nature to choose by doing experiments. Here, there's nobody on the table that actually theorists can all agree are candidates to solve the problem. So it's really kind of an unusual thing that you can identify a problem, but there's no convincing way to think about the problem. And that's probably telling us one of two things. It's probably telling us that the problem isn't a problem, and that we're thinking about the way we set up problems wrong. And you'll see that the role of effective actions in here will be naturalness problems. In the Beyond a Standard Model course, you would have talked about the hierarchy problem. There's a similar problem here, the cosmological constant problem, which is the issue of how much does the vacuum gravitate? How much energy does it have? And the message here will be that we're either thinking about, the naturalness arguments like the hierarchy problem that you use to think about new physics have been used for decades to organize how we think about it. And the biggest threat to those arguments is coming from dark energy in the sense that when you apply them to dark energy, nothing seems to work. So we're either learning there's something wrong with the way we think about naturalness, and that's a guideline of how we think about physics beyond the standard model, or it's telling us that there is a solution, and it's not easy to find. So if you find it, that'll be the way nature works. So it's certainly worth trying to find it. And in that, the historical precedent for that would have been, you know, there's this, in your quantum field theory course, I don't know if it was taught to you this way, but there's this problem. You know, the reason quantum field theory took 20 years to figure out was that at root, there's this basic paradox that relativity, how do I move the boards around? I see. Right. So I press. No, don't want to do that. Oh, the front. I see. There we go. All right. So this is a bit of a tangent, but I can't resist it. So because if you haven't seen it, you should see it. So the essence of the problem of quantum field theory was that relativity and quantum mechanics are almost inconsistent. And the reason I'm telling you this story is it bears on dark energy because the way it played out, it wasn't told this way, but it could have been told this way, that the way the consistency issue got threaded was very bizarre, and that the things, nature had to behave in a very particular way in order for there to be a consistency issue for it to be resolved. And it turns out nature does do the bizarre thing. So what was the thing that had to be solved? So the problem with relativity, you know, relativity, the thing that's exciting about it is speed of light, same for everybody. That all works because motion changes how you perceive time. And because of that, there's a relativity of simultaneity, right? Simultaneity. So there's this issue that we don't all agree on the ordering of events in time. So that if we think that these were simultaneous, but someone comes through the room at the speed of light almost, they think this one was first and this one was second. And that raises a paradox. And Einstein was worried about it because the paradox was if, you know, science is all about predicting the future from the past. And if you can't agree on the ordering of events in time, you can't even agree on what the future and the past are. How can you possibly make a sensible science out of that? So there was a causality issue. How do you, if you can't agree on the ordering of events in time, how do you have a story to tell as to how the future depends on the past? And Einstein gets away with it. He knew that there's a problem, and he gets away with it because nothing goes faster than light, right? So if you have an event A, and you have the forward light cone, which is the, as time goes up, light sweeps out, and space is kind of slicing it that way. If you have an event B over here, different observers can disagree on the ordering of events in time. So for one observer, these might be the points that are all simultaneous, and so then they would say that A is earlier than B. But a moving observer, who's, say, moving that way, would say that the points that are simultaneous might be those ones, and so might say that they're simultaneous, and a differently moving observer might think that B is earlier than A. But the important thing was that if you're disagreeing on the ordering of events, they were space-like separated, so they were never inside the light cone. Everybody agreed on the ordering of events inside the light cone. If one observer thinks C is later than A, then all observers think C is later than A. So you get away with it in relativity because nothing moves faster than light. And in order for you to have these two events influence each other, whose ordering you can't agree on, somebody would have had to move faster than light. That's kind of the saving grace for Einstein. But then the problem with quantum field theory was if you take the uncertainty principle, if you really knew that you were here exactly, then you're arbitrarily uncertain about your momentum. And so there really is a quantum amplitude for you to influence this event, even though you would have had to go faster than light. Because if you look at quantum electrodynamics, there's non-zero amplitudes for things to influence things that are outside the light cone. And so now the problem's back again. If you really at the quantum mechanical level could start here and say send a particle over here with some small quantum probability, and you couldn't agree on the ordering of events in time for those, it seems like you're going to have trouble describing the future in terms of the past quantum mechanically. And yet we do it. And the way we do it in a textbook, they never kind of emphasize this paradox, because you don't want to have students, you know, saying hallelujah every time they calculate something. You really want to make it look practical. And the formalism kind of hides that there's a miracle going on here. But the miracle was the way quantum field theory makes this make sense is that if you think, supposing you think that A is before B, and you think that an electron went from A to B and did something. So it carried a certain amount of charge from here to here. It carried a certain amount of energy from here to here. Then an observer who thinks that B was earlier than A has to have a story that they can tell that makes sense, that accounts for the same events. And so what they say is that there was an antiparticle that carried exactly the opposite charge the other direction, and that it carried the same energy the other direction. But for that to work, you know, antiparticles had to exist, and their interactions had to be exactly the same with one another so that the probabilities of these things going backwards and forwards would be the same. And it had to be true. They had to have exactly the opposite charges and exactly the same masses, which is another way of saying the CPT theorem. All the things you learn about quantum field theory, relativistic quantum field theory, are coming from the resolution of that paradox. And so there was a consistency issue, which seems there was only one way to thread it, which was a very bizarre way, but nature chose that way. And that might be what's going on with dark energy. If you could find an example that works, that's probably the way nature will work, if it's natural. And the problem now is that no one can use that clue, because we don't really have an example of something like this that works, even if it's bizarre. So I don't know if they get, is that a story that's familiar to all you all from the quantum field theory classes? It's a marvelous thing that's at the root of all the weirdness of quantum field theory, relativistically. And the last topic would be, I'll focus on the primordial fluctuations, and that's mostly because it's very similar story to this story here, but it's at later time or earlier times. And so many of the issues that you see here appear there. What's special about it is that people disagree on where what kinds of dynamics might give you these fluctuations, in that some people will think it's a bouncing universe, some people think it's inflation, but they all agree that it's quantum fluctuations that are responsible for these correlations that you see. And so it's the one place in nature where it's believed that quantum fluctuations, in the presence of a gravitationally interesting, where gravity was playing an important role, are observable. And so part of the story there then is, what controls quantum fluctuations in gravity? Doesn't quantum gravity, don't you have to solve quantum gravity for that? And so the effective field theory story here will be that quantum gravity, there's lots of things that are hard, and things you need to know, string theory or whatever else to do. But there is a sense in which you can organize your quantum corrections, even in gravitational situations, where everything is under control. So that's the plan. Any questions about that before we, if you do have questions, just shout them out, because I won't see you otherwise. I'll be looking at the board. All right, so let's get started. So I'm going to start off with the dark matter. And since some of you have done the cosmology, some haven't, I'm going to give a cartoon of the cosmology along the way. But you should, those who haven't done the cosmology, there are lecture notes that, I'm not sure, you probably have more than one source of lecture notes, but there's David Morrissey in one of his earlier versions of this course had lecture notes which are online for you. And section zero has a need to know cosmology. So that kind of gives you an idea what to read if you want to. I'm also going to put out lecture notes, which were not for this course, but it's kind of a big bang, a little bit more detail, and it has some topics that David didn't mention. And those will also be on the webpage. But let me just start you off on that. All right, so what I want to do is go through the evidence for dark matter, mostly to emphasize that there's more than one line of it, and to keep track of which ones are people are successfully getting right and which ones are. Yeah. So we need a scorecard for evaluating how different proposals are doing. And it'll be changing in time as people do better with what they're trying to do. But the context for it all is cosmology and astrophysics. So I guess we should start with astrophysics before doing cosmology. So what I'm doing now is summarizing the evidence for dark matter. And for each of the three topics, I'm going to start off with the evidence for section. So the classic one is the galactic rotation curves. But the thrust of them all is going to be, we're using gravitational means to infer the existence of matter that we can't see. So so we've got galactic evidence. There'll be evidence coming from galaxy clusters. And there'll be three kinds of evidence here. And there'll be several kinds here. And then there'll be evidence from cosmology. So those are the categories we're going to go through. And the galactic one is the most familiar one. You look at a galaxy, you got some sort of a thing, some sort of a spiral. You look at the stars and how they're moving. So they have a speed, and the galaxies that are seen edge on are the easiest ones to do this for, because you can measure their radial velocity using their Doppler shift. And you're not limited to where the stars are. There's clouds of gas inside the galaxy and spiral galaxies, and they often go out past where the stars were, and you can measure their velocities in the same way. And what you typically find is that if you plot, as you know, I think V against the radius, starts off small in the middle, and then it kind of goes up and it does something, but then it basically flattens out. So so here it's basically flat, not quite exactly flat, but if you so in the Newtonian picture, you know that you would have said for circular orbits, you know that you're expecting that v squared over r is going to go like the acceleration, and that'll be g. If it's a spherical distribution of matter, it'll be g times the mass inside the radius over r squared. And so you're expecting that v squared is going like g m of r over r. And of course, what you should be happening is that once you get out past all the matter, then this stops depending on r, so things should fall off with 1 over r, and the puzzle is that it's flat. And so if m were the integral, you know, to r of dx, x squared, 4 pi, rho of x for some density, then having this be flat, so v squared independent of r is corresponding to rho of r going like 1 over r squared, basically. And that's so if you think that gravity is working the way we think it is, the fact that these are flat seems to be saying that there's a density of something going out beyond everything you see, including the gas clouds, which is falling off like 1 over r squared. And the amount of mass there is much larger than the, you know, factors of 10 larger or more, 100 sometimes larger than the mass that you see in the visible stuff. And if you kind of look in the region close to the center of the galaxy, there's normally no evidence for dark matter. There's nothing funny about this v squared curve, so no funny business. And then the transition to where you're something definitely odd is going on, so this is the dark matter dominated. It's happening at some radius. So there's a divider here, which is let's call it the dark matter radius. And if you kind of ask, one question you can ask if you're trying to explain this is how does this dark matter radius depend on the properties of the galaxy you're looking at? Or you could also ask V infinity here, which is where this thing flattens out, how does that depend on the properties of the galaxy you've got? Yeah?
How do you know there's not just regular matter which is transparent to light?
Well, there almost certainly is, yeah.
So is that by definition dark matter?
Yeah, anything that's not doing what, so one thing is that, you could ask kind of, what is this matter if it's there? So I think what 98% of the proposals would be is that gravity is working, there is a distribution like this, and then the question is, what is it, and is it ordinary matter? That's your question is, why? How do we know that's not protons and neutrons that we can't see? And the argument for that is, there's many levels of argument, but the main one is that there's in cosmology ways of counting all the atoms. So you can count all the protons and neutrons regardless of whether you see them, which I'll come to later on. But it's basically you'll see that there's the microwave background. When we get to here, the microwave background and nucleosynthesis, what's happening there, so the nucleosynthesis is the evidence that at one point the universe went through it was once hotter than 10 billion degrees, and it cooled down, and so protons and neutrons found each other and made nuclei. And the reason that the evidence that that was true is that you can calculate the abundance of the nuclei, the light ones, and see if you're getting it right, and they do get it right for the light nuclei. But that story, the way that story works is the answer that you get for the abundances depends on the total number of protons and neutrons, because what's happening is essentially all the neutrons are getting cooked into helium or something else. And this is all happening when the universe is about a minute or so old, so it's an age which is interesting compared to the neutron decay. And so the universe is expanding, and so it's cooling, and all the particles are getting more far apart, and so the nuclear reactions are starting to turn off because you can't find partners to interact with. And there's the abundance that you find for nuclei basically boils down to a competition between, on the one hand, the nuclear reaction rates, which you can calculate, but they're proportional to the number of protons and neutrons that are present, and the expansion rate of the universe, which cares about the total number amount of stuff gravitating at that time. And it also cares a little bit about the neutron decaying. So sometimes they also radioactively decay. But that whole competition of rates works for a specific number of protons and neutrons. So a non-trivial part of the story is that you get the helium abundance right if you have a certain number of protons and neutrons in the universe. But then you get the helium, you know, the helium, that's helium 4 abundance. But you also get the helium 3 abundance right, and you also get the lithium abundance right. And they all, in particular, predict the amount of protons and neutrons you would need. And the sign that you're getting it all, that you really believe the story, is that they all require the same amount of protons and neutrons. And you can also measure the same. So the upshot is that because we know those nuclear reaction rates, you've essentially counted all the protons and neutrons that there are, and there's not enough to be this stuff. That's one line of argument. Same thing's true for the microwave background, that you're seeing essentially hydrogen, and some of the things you're measuring measure the speed of sound in hydrogen, and that cares about the density of hydrogen. So that also is counting the protons and neutrons, so you can get a handle on the total number of protons and neutrons from that. And they all are consistent with nucleosynthesis, but they are too few to give you this. So that's these numbers. The 4% that's left over is what you get from nucleosynthesis. And this number is consistent with what you get from galaxy curves and also these other things. Part of the story will be these, they all point to the same amount of stuff. And it's more than the other arguments that count the baryons allow you to have. So it's really just not that it's there, but it's not known not to be protons and neutrons. So that's a key question. And it's not close either. About 4% of the universe is baryons, but if you count the luminous baryons, the ones you actually see, it's about a 10 times less than that. So it's not like there's luminous baryons are close to what you need. It's they're off by factors of 10 and that kind of thing. All right. So the things if you have a theory you want to deal with is, how does this depend on the properties of the galaxy? How does that depend on the properties of the galaxy? And it turns out there's a simple story. They satisfy a simple thing. And even for ordinary dark matter, there's not a completely convincing picture as to. I think it's fair to say that none of the proposals get them all right in a way which is really would make you smile. There's some of them kind of it's harder than others. So these are like observational rules. So the easiest one to say is that V infinity, it turns out the V to the fourth turns out to be very strongly correlated with the total luminosity of the galaxy. That's called the Tully-Fisher relationship. So if you have a theory of what's going on, you should be able to explain that. And the puzzle there is that this is supposed to be controlled by the dark matter, whatever it is that's dominating at large distances, whereas this is the stuff you see. This is the amount of energy coming out of the galaxy that's visible. So there's some sort of a connection between what you see and what you don't see, which is kind of a bit obscure. And the other thing is that this distance isn't the same for all galaxies. So it's so for our dark matter, you compare it to other scales in the galaxy. And so in a galaxy, they have there's an optical radius, which is kind of the density of stuff in the disk. It depends exponentially with distance, and so there's an exponential scale height, which is measurable by looking at where all the stars are, which you call R optical, or R disk, I guess you could call it. And this thing, so one thing you might say, well, is this thing a fixed fraction of that? And it turns out not. It turns out that if you plot R dark matter over R disk, say, so the distribution of stars. For many galaxies, what happens is that the curves that you get, sorry, no, so what I want to say is plot V, the V of R. So this rotation curve for many galaxies, but we'll do it as a function of R over R disk. So then the dark matter scale will be the scale where this curve V of R kind of transitions from something which is being explained by what you see to something which is not being explained by something you see. So if you plot that, then what you find is that R dark matter over R disk depends pretty much only on the galaxy's luminosity. But it differs for different luminosities. So for small luminosities. These are like dim, very dim galaxies. Our dark matter is well within the disk size, whereas for large, high luminosity galaxies like the Milky Way and things like that, then our dark matter is kind of bigger than or of the order of the disk. So if you thought the way to solve this problem was to say there's some new force in town, and it has a distance, it's got a range, And so there's a physical scale in nature where gravity turns into something else. Then that's a bad description of this phenomenology, because this is not saying there's a fixed distance in nature which all the galaxies are agreeing something happens at. They're saying that there's a scale in the problem which depends on the galaxy, depends on the luminosity of the galaxy, where it happens. And it's not that there's some intrinsic length in nature that we didn't know about. And this can be summarized by, so an efficient way of summarizing it, with the best known modification of gravity that gets us right, gets this thing very right. So this can be summarized by the R for which the acceleration, V squared over R, is equal to about 10 to the minus 10 centimeters per second squared. So some of the proposals for modifying gravity, instead of introducing a length, they introduce an acceleration scale. And then the rule is that the new thing happens once you get to a radius where the acceleration, which is getting smaller and smaller as you get farther away from the center of the galaxy, falls below this scale. And so the picture in those theories is that once the acceleration is smaller than this, something new happens. And that turns out to be a very good description of what you see in galaxies. And so many people get excited by that model. I'm talking about what's called the Mond model. Well, it's because what I have in mind is, supposing you said that there's a new force which has got a Yukawa coupling form or something, so your force law actually has a length in it, then that doesn't capture this phenomenology very well. Because if you actually ask for that force law, where would this transition happen, then you're not led to it depending on the luminosity the way it does. That's essentially the statement. So it's not quite so simple as just saying that there's a fixed length scale at all the galaxies. If all the galaxies at 100 mega, or at 20 megaparsecs did this transition at the same place, that would smell differently than what you're actually seeing. So when we get there, you'll see that this is a huge success for these models. These models are very good at fitting rotation curves in galaxies, and it's because they're capturing this fact of the phenomenology. And they're the ones to beat. They actually do better than dark matter, ordinary dark matter does for this particular phenomenology. But you'll see that when we get to these other evidences, the theory that does that doesn't get anything else right. So there's something going on with galaxies that even in dark matter models is probably not understood very well. But the fact that there's this one parameter captures so much of what's going on in this transition is a bit of a surprise. So now I want to do... I guess I put something. All right. So I'm probably beating galaxies to death here. So I had more things to say about that, but what I'll do is I'll probably come back to that when we talk about the specific thing. But since actually you asked the question, maybe the thing is to say that. So for example, supposing you think that. So this is the way, if we kind of go back to that formula that V squared is GM over R, supposing you say that I'm going to fix things by putting in a new force, a new potential energy, which will also be proportional to the mass, because if we have a fundamental force, it's probably going to couple to every atom in the galaxy, and so it should probably scale with the mass, times some function of R that I'll make up. Then the statement I was going to make over there would be that that so you could choose the R dependence of this thing in order to make V squared be a constant, and it's going to be, if you have, whatever you choose. So if U for large R, so this is large R, is such that V goes to a constant, then what should happen is that that you should be finding then that for large R, if this is going to a constant, this is going to turn into the mass of what you see. That'll be the mass of the galaxy. If you're doing, remember the logic of the proposals where you're modifying gravity are that you're supposed to then not need anything that's not dark. So the mass you're looking at here should be the mass that you see, the visible mass. So if you go for large enough R, this will just become the mass of the galaxy. And you should be predicting that V infinity squared should be proportional to the mass of the galaxy. So the luminous mass. Let's just say mass. Now the reason that that's an issue is that, on the other hand, you know that V to the fourth is proportional to the luminosity observationally. So that would mean that V squared should be proportional to the square root of the luminosity. So you'd be predicting then that, so if V to the fourth is proportional to L, then you'd say that it must be true that M is going like the square root of L. So the luminosity of a galaxy should vary like the square of its mass. And that says that if I take the mass to light ratio of a galaxy, call it epsilon, that should be proportional to 1 over m. Or also, it could be also proportional, I guess, to 1 over root l. And that's not a good description of what you see. So if you actually look at galaxies, you know, you can for regions of it, you can count the mass that you see locally, and you can also count the luminosity. And what you typically find when you do surveys like that, when you can do surveys like this, is that the mass to light ratio is something like the solar mass to light ratio, and it's not varying strongly on the environment of the or the size how big the galaxy is. So this does not seem to work well. So that's kind of an example of how there's information in these galaxies, and it's information which is, because there's so much of it, it's constraining. And that's the utility of it. All right. So there's a similar story with galaxy clusters. I'm taking longer than I thought it was going to take. So for galaxy clusters, the story is, it happens that most galaxies are in clusters. So if you know the space between stars is much bigger than stars themselves are in size, but the space between galaxies isn't really so much. So most galaxies are in clusters of galaxies. And the spacing between them is not so huge compared to the size of the galaxies themselves. And we're in a local group, which is the name of our cluster. And so you can do for galaxy clusters what you also do for galaxies. So we can measure the mass of the clusters in at least three ways. So this is four if you include the count, just count the stars. So this is three ways, which is not relying on seeing the matter. So the first one would be the velocity dispersion of the galaxies themselves.
I've ripped the clip off of the microphone. So that's going to be a problem. All right, we're close to the end here.
Yeah. Take it off for now.
All right, so you see a bunch of galaxies, and you can measure the radial velocity using the Doppler shift. And normally what's happening with the universe expanding is that there's an overall flow. So they all have some sort of a speed or precession, which is proportional to the distance, which is the Hubble flow. But on top of that, there's a certain plus or minus to do with the fact that they're orbiting each other. So it's the differences between the speeds of these galaxies that is the dispersion. So the differences amongst the relative precession velocity of these galaxies should be a measure of the mass that they're orbiting, and the same kind of qualitatively the same as what was happening with galaxies. So the velocity of dispersion, that's the differences. Tracks the mass being orbited. And so basically, through the Virial theorem, so there's a similar story. And so when you do this to estimate, you can estimate the mass that's being orbited by measuring the velocity dispersion. And when you do that, you find that the mass that you would need is factors of 5 to 10 more than the mass that you see, actually more than that probably. And this is, I think, the first evidence for dark matter. This is a Zwicky in the 30s made this observation and made the observation that you're not getting the mass right. But a different way of doing the same thing is, so people, so once you have a theory for dark matter, people invented this theory MOND. They realized that the accelerations in these clusters of galaxies, these accelerations here are bigger than A0. So you never actually get into this regime where modified gravity would kick in. And so when they proposed the model, they recognized that whatever that model is, it's not going to capture this because their criterion is failing, that you're not in a regime. You're seeing things that are not there, but you're doing it when the acceleration is not in that nice, satisfying that nice criterion that is less than A0. Good. So, but then people actually found many more baryons in clusters than you have in the galaxy. So the second thing was, once you look at cluster galaxies in X-rays, so if you do the same thing in X-rays, then you see there's a big smear bigger than the galaxies that kind of is radiating in X-rays. And so since it's radiating X-rays, that's hot gas, much hotter than the sun. The surface of the sun is thousands of degrees, and that's kind of visible light. X-rays are going to be much more, that's more like the corona of the sun. So there's a hot hydrogen gas here. So the radiating X-rays. And so that's telling you something about the motion of the gas molecules, right? That the same argument you make for the galaxies, you can now do for the gas molecules. And in that case, the average speed of the molecules is being set by the temperature of the gas. And so you're measuring the temperature with the radiation. So what we can do is, so by looking at the X-rays and hot gas, they satisfy an equilibrium condition, which will be that 1/1 their density times their radial derivative of their pressure will be minus their acceleration. That'll be the fluid mechanics of it. And they're a gas, so basically it's an ideal gas, so this will be the number density times temperature. If I use units where Boltzmann's constant is 1. So that'll be the density, the mass density times the temperature divided by the average mass per particle. So if I divide by temperature and multiply by R, this thing says that the rho, d log r, is d log temperature, d log r, is equal to minus r times the average mass divided by temperature times acceleration. And experimentally, you can measure these things. So what they measure is that the temperature is basically R independent. And the density seems like it goes like rho to the alpha, where alpha is something like minus two to minus one. So this is basically an alpha. And this is basically zero. That's a constant. So that says that R times the acceleration is a constant. And the acceleration is the thing that would have been, so R times the acceleration is what in Newton's language would have been gm over R. So it's telling you the same story the galaxies were telling you, that gm over R looks like it's a constant, the same way in the galaxies it was V squared that was measuring that, but now you're seeing it in a V squared and the molecule of the gas, essentially. So the fact that the temperature is R independent is another way of saying that the velocities are R independent. So it's doing much like what the galaxy did. And the mass you infer, if you ask how much mass do I need, it's the first statement is that there's more atoms in this gas than there is in the galaxies. So if you count the stars and the galaxies, you get a big number for the mass. But if you count the mass in this hot gas, there's more stuff in the gas than there is in the galaxies. And so Zwicky and company was right to say that you could be missing things, but is still not enough. The mass that you need to describe the velocity dispersion and the temperature of the gas is more than the mass of the gas, which is the mass of galaxies, and by the same kind of factor that you need for galaxies. And the third way you can do this for galaxies, clusters, is by lensing. So you sit here, you have a galaxy in the background or a cluster in the background, and it sends images. So a galaxy in the background, the light from it is being bent by this stuff. And sometimes it's strongly bent, so you get these things get distorted to arcs, but more often it's just weakly bent. So these little ellipses that were within the galaxies are being distorted from the ellipse they would have had. And so statistically, you can pick up whether or not there was something in the foreground, because this distorts them all kind of in a systematic way, where they're all distorted relative to where the mass was. So if they're all distorted kind of radially compared to where the mass is, then you can tell that apart from just random orientation of the galaxies. So that's called weak lensing. So weak lensing can also measure the mass. And they all agree. So it disagrees with this, agrees with that, and they disagree with this little stuff by a certain fraction. And the poster child of this comparison is that for most of these galaxies, they're all kind of at the same place. Most of these clusters of galaxies, the X-rays and the mass spectral lensing and the galaxies are all together, and the bullet cluster is this famous example you've probably seen pictures of, where you've got essentially two groups of galaxies. And they're inferred to be moving away from each other because if you do the gas story, you look at where the X-rays are, that's all here in between them. But when you do the lensing story, it's all here and here. And so it looks like what's happened is the gas is what would happen if the galaxies, if the cluster had passed through one another, the galaxies would miss each other basically in the dark matter that's there misses each other apparently, but the gas doesn't, so it tends to shock and you get this kind of, it stops in between and it's heated up. So that's what's nice about that one is that it's actually the dynamics of this thing has moved the gas away from the mass. But the mass you track with the galaxies and the mass you track with the lensing is not in the same place as the gas. So whatever you are describing dark matter with has to do all these things. And it's kind of a, this is probably a good thought. There's a whole bunch of evidence also from cosmology which did not rely on galaxies. But to do that, I should probably remind you what the cosmology is a bit, so I'll start that.